If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 164. I'm Chris, and with me today is...
I am Matt.
And we're going to be talking about tech. And I know this is not Matt's expertise, but he always has some interesting anecdotes to throw in. So we're dubbing this show Processing Power because we're going to talk about one of my favorite things in the world, and that's processors, CPU processors. So as you know, from a largely cultural thing going on right now, and I say it's cultural because it's part of this is a result of what I would call COVID culture, and that is we are having processor CPU shortages in many industries. You can't get GPUs for, you know, from NVIDIA and AMD, GM and Ford and some of these companies are not able to get processors so that they can build body control modules and media control modules and all this for their cars. As a matter of fact, GM said they were going to release a vehicle without a processor, selling them in 2021, which actually, without the processor, the vehicle will not be as fuel efficient as the 2020 models. But, you know, cars used to not have any computers in them, and in some respects, I think they were better off that way. They're certainly much easier to work on. But one of the things I've been talking about for a while, and I know everybody is probably tired of hearing me bang this drum, but ARM is the future. Not saying that x86, x64 processors are going away anytime soon, but I think the significance of their importance in overall processing is going to be declining over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Unless something happens and they just re-architect, they're able to make some breakthrough that is a game changer, which I just don't see it. We've had the x86 architecture for a long, long, long time. All technologies at some point
eventually outlive their usefulness.
They're just something new comes along that is much more disruptive and replaces them. Not because necessarily the technology was bad, but because, you know, progress marches on. And that being said, we've kind of known for a while that ARM-based chips, which primarily were in things like tablets and cell phones, but think about how ubiquitous a cell phone is. Even in places, you know, third world countries that don't have clean water everywhere, almost everybody has access to a cell phone. It's weird. It's almost like Star Trek.
Well, in Star Trek, they would have had clean water, too.
Yeah, that true. Well, that's the next part. Dean Kamen, I thought you were working on this problem. But Qualcomm last year bought a company called Nuvia. And, you know, and Qualcomm is a huge producer of ARM chips, because they make probably, if Apple makes a third of all the ARM chips with their A series chips and now their M series chips that they're putting in desktops and laptops, Qualcomm probably makes another 40% that goes in almost every Android phone. And then, you know, even non-smartphones, they're making the processors and have been for a long time. And then other ARM manufacturers probably have that last 27% split up among them. But they bought a company called Nuvia, and it was founded by Gerard Williams III, who is Apple's former chief CPU architect, and he's now Qualcomm's senior VP of engineering. And they're going to follow Apple's example of selling laptop and desktop, powerful laptop and desktop custom ARM processors, But for Qualcomm. So what does that mean? So Qualcomm makes the Snapdragon, which was actually Microsoft uses in their Surface Pro X, the Cryo. It's not the Snapdragon, but they make the Cryo CPUs that are in the Surface Pro X. And they're also called I'm trying to read my show notes here. But so they have experience making essentially a laptop performance or a premium laptop performance processor. Is it powerful as compared to Apple? No, not at all. It actually lags behind their A series chips. But part of that is because, for the most part, Qualcomm just takes the standard ARM chips, our ARM reference designs, and they modify them, you know, very, very basically, and then they sell them as Snapdragons or Cryos or whatever. And so the purpose of buying Nuvia is so that they can make custom ARM chips, build their own silicon using ARM cores that will do things like the Apple M1 chip. And why is that important? Well, one, like I said, they already make the processors for the Microsoft Surface X, which is their premium Surface product. So it's going to make that more competitive in the market. But I think also, too, they are seeing the limit. They're seeing the opportunity where the limitation in, particularly in Intel's x86 processors, are, you know, there's this gap that needs to be filled, and they can do it. Plus, you know, again, they see Apple as a competitor in the smartphone space. They don't want to be so far behind that they're not even in the, you know, in the same galaxy as Apple when it comes to desktop and laptops. Because, I mean, let's face it, Apple makes their products, I won't say, are premium in the sense of price as compared to a similarly configured product, but they do make premium products that have cachet. There's a whole part of the market Apple chooses not to address. It's not the part of the market they want to hit. And this is a place where I think Qualcomm goes, you know, we could seriously start hitting this lower end part of the market with ARM-based chips. And I have a feeling because they've been working with Microsoft on the Surface Pro X today, I think they have a good idea that Microsoft also sees the future of the end user. I hate the word personal computing, because personal computing indicates that all you are is a web server, but end user computing is really what it should be called. You know, where you need something more powerful than a tablet, but, you know, like a laptop, but something that is going to be far more efficient than the current generation of Intel-based CPUs. Thoughts?
I'm more intrigued by your definition of personal computing.
Well, that's the beauty of the podcast, is we can go wherever wording takes us.
I mean, I think that's an interesting argument you make there. Because, quite frankly, the personal computing market has really been geared towards two things. The gamers and the web surfers. And I think there is a third category there that has been largely ignored since IBM sold off their personal computing division to the Chinese, which I think is a market that should be tapped in on the PC side.
So, you know, my definition is prefaced on a couple things, because I agree personal computing was largely, to me, it was largely, even more so than the web servers. The web servers, most people who surf the web surf on their phone anymore. So I kind of take that out. And you know, people who want a bigger experience, they get an iPad or a Galaxy, Samsung Galaxy Tab. You know, it's one of the tablet platforms that exists out there. But it's particularly true in the COVID environment. But there's, you know, business, end-user business computing, those products are no different than the products that we would consider, you know, for other end-user uses. Right. Or personal computing uses. And then you have the fact that a lot of companies, because of COVID, have realized we don't need to have offices. We don't need to maintain and necessarily maintain the hardware infrastructure that we would have to have in an office. So instead of me providing you with a PC, why don't you go find the PC that you want, you know, whether it's a laptop or desktop, and when you set it up in your home, and then we will provide the software piece that wraps around there, whether it's Office 365, you know, security systems, whether you're going to use your system with Citrix or VMware HorizonView and have a virtual desktop experience where we're hosting another instance, but the hardware is yours. And that's why I think end user computing is much more encompassing than saying it's personal computing.
No, I agree with
you
that.
Know, and the fact that you have a lot of people now. I mean, I've worked from a home office, mobile office, since 2003. You know, I haven't had a where I sat in, you know, and even before that, I traveled a lot. So my laptop or laptops in some cases that went with me where I was traveling, you know, that was my office at the time. So I have a jaded perspective on that anyway, but COVID, I think, also brought about the fact that a lot of people, because they lost their jobs, had to figure out how to make an income. And so we saw a lot of small businesses, but not in the traditional sense, businesses that people could run from their home. And so, you know, there's a lot of business use in this end-user computing wrapped around, you know, your business accounting and your business documents and all of that. And there's email and, you know, quite a bit of web surfing that a lot of these businesses do because they interface with their suppliers or other partners via that medium.
Yeah.
But again, what this whole end user or personal computing experience, what's important, and a lot of people don't think about this, is that this is the stuff where the rubber meets the road. This is where people get their work done. You know, it's not like you have to go into a data center anymore to do, you know, process a report and so this change to ARM processors is an important step in the evolution because it's going to do several things. One, ARM processors, so even if they're specialized, are so much more efficient than x86. Because again, you have a technology that's been around since the 70s. And so there's a lot of engineering compromise. There's a lot of baggage and stuff that probably, if you were looking at it from a pure engineering standpoint, should have been engineered out of the x86 product. I mean, look how long it took x86 and the software companies, you know, the OS makers like Apple and the open source community and Microsoft to get rid of 32-bit operating systems, with Microsoft being, frankly, the last to move to a pure 32-bit architecture. And even they haven't yet, because they still have 32-bit applications that they're supporting. And when I say support, they're still doing active development, which is, you know, most other platforms, it's like, well, our OS is 64-bit. Here's your transition period to 60, you know, changing your application to 64-bit, which in most cases is not hard. But again, it's that same thing there's a lot of baggage that goes along with design and architecture, and they can't, they don't feel like they can make the cutoff be, okay, here's the last date you do this. Look at Microsoft is the most wishy-washy company I've ever dealt with. They're still selling support for Windows 7.
There's a reason for all of that. If there wasn't a market for service for Windows 7, they wouldn't do it.
True.
There are IT communities that just will not give up legacy software because that crap works. They don't want to change.
Yeah, but here's the problem with that mentality. On the flip side of it, it's just like anything that's older. There are, whether it's hardware or software, in today's world, there's so many vulnerabilities in old hardware and old software, particularly old software. Hardware vulnerabilities are harder to take advantage of unless you're physically with the system. Software vulnerabilities, that's where you get remote code execution and privilege elevation and all of that. They're not fixing any of that because they can't afford to keep active development on that.
Sure, and I get that, but this is where I come back and say it. The reason why they're so hesitant is reliability and comfort level. They just don't want to learn a new system. They don't want to learn a new software package to do something that they've been doing for years, and it works.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that's a great process for if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, when you're talking about business processes and things like that. But when it comes to technology, that's just not the case. I mean, there are some, if you get outside of computer technology, yeah, there are technologies that you can afford to wait on because, you know, yeah, the new technology might have more efficiency. Like a good example is an elevator. You know, if I have an elevator that is not computer controlled, but it still gets me from floor to floor to floor reliably, and it's very simple to maintain, should I upgrade it? You could probably hold that decision off for 3 or 4 decades. If I have a computer system that's controlling SCADA systems or the accounting processes in my company, I don't know that I would reliably trust letting a decade pass before seriously looking at upgrading those systems. Now, do you need to re-engineer those systems from scratch? Probably not. Sometimes technology moves along and you know, and that's the scary part, I think, for a lot of entities is technology moved along and it's not so much that what you're doing is wrong, but there's a lot of vulnerability in the software or hardware that you're running on. I mean, hardware vulnerability from a security perspective is not just hackers and things. It is, can I get parts? What happens if something breaks? Can I bring this, you know, can I easily get parts to bring the system back up? That's part of that reliability issue. And, you know, once you're outside of a decade, unless you had your own stockpile of something, it is hard to get some of that stuff. Or the alternative is, because, and this is something that I've noticed more recently, is that, like, I have an older third-gen Core i3 processor, and I have a bad motherboard. I know the processor works because I have a working board that it will work on, and I tested it. I was out on Amazon just looking to see if they had a board that would support it. And they did. They had about 10 of them. They were all made by these unnamed Chinese companies. and they're probably fine. But, you know, there's, depending on the industry you're in, that those are not an option to being able to insert into your company's technology if you had to replace that. You know, because there's, particularly like U.S. government, you have ITAR and other regulations that say where final assembly and or manufacturer have to be for certain types of products.
But the business world ain't the U.S. government.
Yes, but the business world, the real business world, the data center guys, they're so much better about planning ahead
Well, I get that, but what I'm getting at, but though,
those folks who are on Windows 7,
those are decisions that are being made by businesses
because
that aren't regulated like that.
Correct, and those decisions were made based on the fact that, am I going to lose revenue when I worked for General Motors while I was in college as a summer hire, which, taught me the fact that I could work just about any job if I had to. But I worked on the assembly line. And one of my jobs on the assembly line was I worked at a factory that produced SUVs, and I was to drive the SUV off the assembly line, pull it into a station where there was a guy underneath with a wrench, and he would adjust the toe-in. And if you don't know what the toe-in on a car is your front tires are not necessarily exactly straight ahead, because when you turn, it causes tension and the tires will wear funny. So what they do is they cant the tires in so many degrees in the front. It also makes the vehicle track better on the highway, so it'll always roll straight. And the guy, I would pull it in, I'd put this thing on the steering wheel that would hold the steering wheel in top dead center so that it was perfect. And then the guy had a computer down there, and he would adjust the toe in, and the computer would talk to that thing that I put on the steering wheel. And then I would adjust the headlights, and then I would pull it off the line. Well, one night I got in one truck and the transmission was locked up. It would not move out of park. But the problem is you have so many seconds to get that car off the line, or they have to stop the assembly line, or it's just going to, you know, plow into each other. And so they had to stop the line. Well, GM knew down to the penny how much money they lost for every second of the line was down.
Sure.
And so a lot of IT decisions, they don't lightly take into just doing wholesale transformations, but anything that would affect the bottom line, whether that is software vulnerability and hacking and everything else, they would address that immediately, because they knew that if something like that happened and it stopped the line, they could guarantee how much, based on that day's figures or that year's figures, how much money they would lose. There's no real companies out there, or very few real companies, who are running legacy versions of Windows for their production system, except ATM companies, which is really, really shocking, because that is a place that's, one, I hardly ever use an ATM. I don't usually need cash anymore anyway in today's society, but that is one of the places where banks over time, because they outsource ATM, and those guys are usually smaller regional players, where they have not stayed up because it for them, they think it's too costly.
Well, I think that's what a lot of businesses think.
Now, small businesses, yeah, I see them not doing stuff like that, and that's potentially to their detriment, because the problem is...
Well, even medium-sized businesses are concerned about the bottom line kinds of decisions.
But the problem is if you have... Here's where it's devastating. If you have... And it is a game you play if you're doing this. But if you have any sort of breach where any personal information, and it does not have to be your customer's personal information, it can be your employees. And that can be something as simple as somebody got in and stole everybody's current resume. That is, you can be sued out of existence for that. Yeah, if something happens and all that information is released, will your insurance company cover it? Yeah, once. Unless you're a Target and those big companies have...
Yeah.
But they pay millions and millions in liability for what happens. But little companies, it's over. You have a breach, and that's the game you play. And I've seen it. It is federally mandated at this point in the United States that all businesses who take credit card transactions should have switched to chip and PIN. And there's not, I don't know how many gas stations you go into.
Yeah.
And the chip reader
is broken.
It's not broken. It's never been activated. Oh, we do it by swipe. My bank won't accept a swipe anymore.
I was never a big fan of the chip anyway.
I like the chip. I think part of it is because I have a deep understanding of how it works from a cryptographic standpoint. Can they be defeated? Absolutely. I mean, it's just a matter of time before somebody finds a way to circumvent some of these things. But is it harder to circumvent? Much, much harder, you know?
Well, I think my aversion to it was the bank I was using at the time. They when they mandated the switch, they took their sweet time mailing me the new card.
Oh, yeah.
And then they mailed it to the wrong address, and then they had to send it again. And, you know, I'm bills are piling up, but I can't pay because I don't have the freaking card to pay it, and nonsense like that. So I just was agitated with the technology to begin with, and it wasn't really the technology's fault. It was the freaking bank's fault, but
yeah,
here we are.
Well, we went to Great Britain in 2014. And so 2014 was the beginning of the switch in the United States. And my bank at the time had not issued cards with chips in them. And I'll tell you, it was a hell of a hard paying for things in Great Britain because they had been on the chip and pins system for years. And a lot of the people who worked at like restaurants and stuff, they could accept swipes, but they didn't know how to operate the equipment to make it accept swipe because they had, everybody, you know, is put your chip in and you put your pin in and you were done.
Yeah.
And that was tough. But I've come to appreciate the technology since then.
Well, and the other thing that was aggravating about the chip was that the readers didn't work very well early on.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of software problems. It wasn't that the hardware was bad. It was, you know, the merchants and the credit card processing companies that they used didn't, they were not prepared for something they knew was inevitably coming. And that's what I find irritating about it today. Particularly, so I'm going to pick on someone. I'm going to pick on Speedway gas stations. So most Speedway gas stations today accept the pin, chip and pin inside. But for years, they never had chip and pin on their gas pumps. You know, when you'd pay at the pump, it was always a swipe. And I just noticed over about the last 18 months that if they don't have a chip reader, the bank will not, my bank, which is a federal credit union, will not accept the swipe in a gas pump. But recently...
So then how does that work? Because the transaction's done. You've left the gas station by that point, right?
No, because they pre-authorize your card before.
Ah, okay.
When you pay at the pump, you put your card in and swipe and they pre-authorize it. And if the pre-authorization doesn't take, then you have to go in and pay for it.
With cash.
Or you can, a lot of times you can use your card. It's kind of weird because the pumps don't have a card reader in them. They have a swipe reader, but not a card, a chip reader. But inside they typically have chip readers.
Okay.
So, But what's funny is, so Speedway didn't do that forever. But now Speedway's ahead of everybody because now they have the chip reader and the near field communications reader. And so now you can do like Apple Pay at the pump. And nobody else around here lets you do that. You know, you can do Apple Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay. So let's loop back around to processing power. Although that was tangentially
related.
So I'm going to say a statement here that is very important. From a CPU perspective, and I'm talking across the board, from the lowest level CPU that Intel makes to their biggest data center CPUs, they are in trouble. They've got a marketing campaign going on right now to try to discredit all of their competitors. But from a processing power perspective, both speed, number of cores, energy efficiency, everything, Intel is in serious trouble. They sat on their laurels too long, and a lot of people have surpassed them technologically. Apple's one. I think this new VO is going to be a big thorn in the side of Intel. AMD just released their new EPYC, which is their data center platform processor, and it is more than twice as fast for a third of or a third less cost than Intel's just released high-end Xeon processor. And they just announced their Rocket Lake, which is their latest 11th gen processors that came that they made the announcement they're going to launch later, like next week. And essentially all the pre-release units that are out there that they give to, you know, people to review and everything, everybody's saying wait till the next version. Because they released a new Core i9 desktop, Core i7 desktop, you know, which is desktop chips typically in that the i series, you know, those are their premium, more powerful chips, because usually you tune them down a little bit for mobile so that they're more power efficient and don't burn up your batteries. But they roughly offer the same amount of performance with fewer cores. So, and there's explanations for this. Basically, they were supposed to move to a 10 nanometer process, which would have increased the power efficiency and things on these chips, but they felt they needed to release something. And so they released the 10 nanometer technology on 14 nanometer chips, which makes them less efficient. It created some artificial limitations in them. But, you know, the issue is so, like, and one of the articles and things I was looking at, so there were some leaked CPU Z benchmarks, and the performance difference between their new Core i7 and their new Core i9 was less than 5 points, so it was a rounding error. AMD's Ryzen 9 5950, which was announced and released last month, was 660 points higher. So that's like 50% faster than their Core i9. And their new Core i9, their flagship product, was about 15% less powerful than AMD's Ryzen 7 5800X that they announced last month. That's significant. That means AMD is at least a generation or two from a performance perspective greater than Intel is. And you know, that's typically you see a leapfrog thing. The problem is there's no leapfrogging going on. Even if Intel comes up with another chip, by the time that happens, Ryzen or AMD will release a new set of Ryzen chips. On the data center side, Intel has been playing the game of lowering core count or lowering clock core speed, but increasing the number of cores so you can do more threads, which means you can do more processes at once. AMD has been doing the same thing, except they've been increasing the processor thread and increasing the core count much greater than Intel is. And so they're not just a couple generations ahead. They're probably 5 or 6 generations ahead from a performance perspective for Intel to catch up. Unless Intel, like I said, comes through with some serious breakthrough that's just going to blow everybody out of the water. But it isn't going to happen. So you have AMD competing in their x86 space. You have Apple's M1 chips, which are blowing them out of the water on ARM, you now have Qualcomm coming in with what will, you know, it's safe to bet that they will come up with something that's similarly competitive with Apple's M1 series. And you'll see, just like Intel and AMD are playing this game, you'll see Apple and Qualcomm play this game, you know. But again, Apple and Qualcomm will be playing this game up at the AMD Epic, you know, area. We're 7 or 8 generations ahead of you for you to catch up. So it's kind of weird. Plus, I think Intel is, they've diversified so much that they can't keep their eye on the ball anymore. You know, it's, yeah, what are we known for? When you say Intel, everybody knows, you know, almost, when I hear Intel, the first thing that comes to mind is Pentium. Because that's when the Pentium chips first came out. Because, again, AMD and Cyrix and a whole bunch of other companies back in the 386, 486 days, they competed really, really well with Intel. But Intel kind of broke that chain when they came out with the Pentium chip. And it took Cyrix and AMD and a lot of them actually had to consolidate during that period. And Intel held a distinctive lead until AMD got back into the game with the Athlon. And then they've been playing leapfrog ever since. But like Intel has decided that they want to get in the GPU game. So they're also this, they've released test samples for people to review of their new Xe HPG DG2 gaming GPU, a dedicated PCIe card. I'm going to compete with AMD again, and now Nvidia, and their in their marketplace. Am I sad that they're doing it? No, I want to see more competition. You know, we used to have there were probably 20 different cards you could buy. You know, when MSI had their own chipset, when you know there was the Voodoo and the Voodoo 2. And then you had ATI, which is now AMD, and you had Nvidia, and you know, and there were 5 or 6 others who were out there who were making GPUs, dedicated GPUs for computers, 2D at first, and then, you know, then later in 3D, and then for years it's just been, you know, largely Nvidia and AMD /ATI out there. And so, you know, do I want to see something new and something that's going to provide competition in the market? Absolutely. But the testing on this card says that their OpenCL test results were really bad. So bad, in fact, that they are worse than GeForce 500 series. So a GTX 550, you know, which... How old is that at this point?
I've heard of it. That ought to tell you something.
And that was the old NVIDIA Fermi architecture. So, you know, now, they expect performance to be on par with current modern-day graphic cards with better drivers. This article, that I don't see it happening. If you're that far behind, how can your drivers be that bad? You know, it's not like Intel hasn't been... They announced that they were doing this like 5 years ago, that they were going to be building dedicated GPUs. I think what's happened is they figured out it was a lot harder than they thought it was. They thought, I'm a CPU vendor and I have all this stuff. GPUs are just CPUs for video cards, you know? but we're also going to see when they do announce these for public consumption, if they can even produce them because of the chip shortage. They're supposed to have a variable plethora of SKUs to compete with all the levels that AMD's offering in the Radeon line and NVIDIA's offering in the RTX and GTX lines. It's just weird. So, let's see. So, other thing that I think is also hurting Intel, when I said Intel was in bad shape, is that the next generation of Surface devices. So since 2019, there has been an AMD Ryzen Surface Edition processor that they've built for a specific 15-inch model of their... Well, actually, there's two of them. There's an i5 variant and an i7 variant that you could buy in a... But it was only in the 15-inch version of the Surface laptop. Surface Laptop 3, I guess. And now they're planning to offer Ryzen chips in all of their Surface products as an option. You can still get Intel versions, but you can get Ryzen ones. I think that's probably scary to Intel, because for the most part, yeah, they do a good business with Apple. And Apple provided them a lot of cachet, in a market that for most people is shrinking. To have their other big player, you know, who is really probably Intel's rise to fame is probably directly tied to Microsoft Windows, and have them offer their biggest competitor or one of their biggest competitors' chips in products in their premium product. I think that's probably, you know, gonna cause a few more knee-jerk reactions. Because it's kind of funny, you know, they brought Pat Gelsinger as the new CEO of Intel over from VMware. And this guy, he's been in the industry for years and years and years and years. He is a marketing guy. He is not a technology guy. I mean, yeah, he markets for technology companies, but they brought him in because they were looking for somebody to flash up their deficiencies. And so, like, one of the first things they've done is they have a new ad campaign going on, and they got Justin Long, you know, who is Mac from I'm a Mac, to talk about how much greater Intel processors are than the Apple M1. The problem is, and this is where people have gotten a lot more savvy over the years, back in the day when the Pentium 2 came out and they were competing against the what I would call the last generation of PowerPC processors from Apple,
uh-huh.
where the PowerPC processor at a lower clock speed, if you were running the same app, it blew Intel out of the water. It was at least 20% faster. So the G3 was about 20% faster than the Pentium 2. The G4 was about, it was actually more than 20%. It was probably about closer to 30 to 35% faster than the Pentium 3. And then, you know, the G5 competed against the Pentium 4. And again, it had a performance boost in direct comparison, you know, using the same either synthetic benchmarks or real world use like Photoshop and things like that. But Intel doubled down hard on marketing during those times, you know, to try to pick on Apple. And Apple just did one of the things that they did really well, particularly in the early days with Steve Jobs, and that was, well, let's concentrate on the benchmarks. And Apple always goes back to that place because people who really care, that's what happened. Well, since then, a lot of, you know, only the most technical people really cared about benchmarks back then. I don't think it's going to work as well here because it's not just Apple who is out benchmarking Intel. It's all their competitors. And I think even seasoned people will go, why is Justin Long, you know, I guess you can pay somebody. He needed some work because, and that's exactly a couple of articles I read. That's exactly what the people have said. And these were non-technical people. They're going, yeah, Intel's in trouble. You know, and Justin Long must have needed some work because...
Well, Justin Long is an actor.
Yeah.
This is the other thing that kills me about marketing guys. They think that Justin Long, because he played a part in a series of commercials, is going to truly be influential in tech.
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah, I mean... Just it was, stupid marketing. You know, back when they had the Mac versus PC commercials, it was fun. It was humorous how Apple did it. But when you're the first one to do something and it's humorous and fun, it doesn't look like a cheap shot. And, you know, like if you take the same people and you're the second person to do it, to have it explain away your point of view. I think, but when you're backed into a corner, those are the types of things you find companies, and particularly companies who now have to address the marketing angle to get stuff done. And don't get me wrong, Apple is a marketing beast, but they're going to answer this not by doing something like that. You know, they're gonna hit it twofold. They're gonna hit it with, well, this is the numbers, you know, using these standardized benchmarks and standardized real world use, and then they're gonna do something new and original from a marketing perspective. Because it's not like Steve Jobs was the one who goes, let's do the I'm a Mac campaign. I've got this all written out and done this. No, I mean, you know, yes, was he super influential in Apple when he was alive? Yes. Was he the only reason they did so well? No. Now, was he influential in the fact that he built a team of people who could do this stuff? Absolutely. That was probably his greatest leadership role, was building the team that could do it and then maintain it. Because, I mean, when you look at the people on the team that he has, you know, who are there, I can name maybe one who has similar charisma to Jobs. Tim Cook certainly doesn't have it, you know. Phil Schiller is like my neighbor, you know. Federici? Yeah, he's got the chutzpah. But so Apple was supposed to, well, on top of all of this, everybody was predicting Apple was going to have an event in March. Why? Because over the years and the last decade, they've had so many. Somebody went out and they went through and like all the Apple events and when they make announcements and they showed the dates and, you know, how many times these announcements fell in March, and so everybody was thinking that there was going to be an Apple March event. They actually thought it was around the 16th, which would have been this week, but I kind of knew that that was not going to happen. So then they were saying it's the 23rd. Now they're saying it's in April, which I would probably guess. I think Apple is, they try not, they're somewhat predictable in these things, but then when they get to be too predictable, that's when they change, or they'll change it up. Because there are some like Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference is always in June, and they always make some sort of announcement there. Last year it was the M1 Max. The year before, I think it was the Mac Pro. I mean, you know, or the new Mac Pro, the ones that cost like $64,000. But you know, Apple has such a breadth of products. But not like such a breadth of products like Dell sells, but they're so influential, people, you know, track when they're going to release updates. And so the idea was that new iPad Pros will come out because they announced new iPad Airs earlier, another new iPad Mini. Supposedly, they're switching to mini LED displays, so the sharper colors and particularly deeper blacks with a wider contrast ratio. Possibly the iPad Pro will have an M1 processor instead of an A series processor. It's supposed to have Thunderbolt on it and a new Magic Keyboard, which will also have a trackpad. And then a new Mac Mini with an iPad Mini with an 8.4 inch screen, which would be a considerably larger, smaller iPad. But everything else is likely to be the same. They're suggesting AirPods 3, the mysterious Apple AirTags that have never come out despite being talked about and references for them in beta builds of the OS, you know, iOS and macOS. there was possibility, also a refresh of the Apple TV, but that's largely no change in the functionality. It's just a newer model with faster processor, maybe a little more storage. On the outside was the possibility of, you know, an M-series iMac as the next iteration of Apple Silicon, because they do expect both a 14 and a 16-inch MacBook Pro to come out with Apple Silicon later in the year. It may not be the, it's going to be an M-series chip, but probably not the M1, because particularly a 16-inch MacBook Pro, they're going to want to have at least 32 gigs of shared memory, if not 64 gigs. So Apple discontinued their iMac Pro, which is no surprise. You don't update something in 2 years, because that was kind of a stopgap measure from the previous Mac Pro to the newer, extremely expensive Mac Pros. Just the usual stuff, you know. Except that, you know, they're also talking about an AR headset. Microsoft, did their virtual, because their developer Ignite, Microsoft Ignite, their developer convention was completely virtual this year, and of course all virtual things end up being free instead of having to pay for them. And they spent a lot of time on Microsoft HoloLens, their AR headset. Everybody's moving to this. And Microsoft played it more as VR instead of AR. I think AR is more realistic. Microsoft did show off some cool things with it. But like their headset is essentially like wearing a hard hat with glasses attached to them. I don't think Apple's going to release something so crude. I also don't think they're going to release a complete VR headset. Because the issue with VR is that you need to block out the rest of reality for virtual reality to be functional.
Right.
But augmented reality makes a lot of sense. I can see, particularly even Microsoft with their demo, like one of the things they were doing is they were in an automated machine shop where they had CNC machines and all this. And there was an instructor, master toolmaker, teaching a new hire how to operate and load the machine. And so that they both had HoloLens on, and you could see when the instructor would say something, it would highlight, you know, in an augmented reality area, this is the piece I'm talking about, and this is how you have to do this. And so there were some immediate applications that made sense. I can also see AR being something like, from a more personal level, I don't want to say personal computing level, but personal level. So like maybe Google Maps or Apple Maps or Waze would use an AR set of glasses to augment your driving, like a HUD on an aircraft, except it's showing you the path that you need to go, and hey, you need to take exit 138 over here, or there's an accident ahead, slow down, you know, that kind of thing. So you don't have to take your eyes off and necessarily listen to a GPS device, whether it's on your phone or a dedicated GPS. That makes sense to me. It also makes sense if you're doing directions, like in walking directions in a city or biking directions in a city, you know. But the rumor is that they're going to launch in 2022. It will be interesting to see what they launch, because it will not be what everybody else has. I don't believe that. I think they'll be criticized because it won't have all the functionality of what's like, you know, Oculus Rift and Microsoft HoloLens will have out of the box. But I think it'd be something that people were more likely to adopt than, and cost wise, it will be less. But it'll plug into that Apple ecosystem. You know, it'll be like your Apple Watch. You'll have to have an iPhone to make it work. And things like that. But I think pricing will be according. Right now, the estimated pricing for HoloLens is, unless people will not be buying these for home use. Let's just put it that way. You know, the infrastructure required to make it work is not going to happen. But it's kind of funny, the people who are making these predictions, and some of them have very good track records with being able to read the tea leaves, and particularly the Apple tea leaves, and see, you know, make accurate predictions on what they're going to release and when they're going to release it. They've got it that they're going to have augmented reality contact lenses by the 2030s. So 8 years from today. It'd be interesting. So, last but not least is Microsoft is claiming that their Sun Valley update to Windows 10, which is the next major Windows 10 update, will get rid of pesky unwanted apps that always find their way onto a fresh Windows installation. Meaning, all that crapware that gets loaded by all the Windows OEMs. So like you buy a new gaming PC and it has, you know, Microtrends antivirus or McAfee or, you know, all the guys who make like Marble Blast Gold and, you know, their gaming app that's super annoying to get rid of. Basically, you'll be able to go into settings and get rid of those low usage apps. There's a Windows Insider preview that gives you the option to like delete those, but then it also they're no longer going to pre-install on new machines 3D Viewer, Paint 3D, or the 3D Objects folder, and that was based upon feedback that they got from the user base that, look, nobody's using Windows. It's a very small sub-market where you have creators who are 3D artists who are using, even possibly using those functions. So don't pre-install them because you think that's a selling point. So you've been quiet, Matt. Any other thoughts?
No, I think you've pretty much covered it.
Well, that being said, we want to hear from you, our listener. Please send us feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.